James Corbett is joining us now. Hello, James. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Alfred. Thank you for having me back on, as always.
Always a pleasure to have you back on the program. How's the Corbett Report doing?
Well, I would say it's doing fairly well. And as a matter of fact, since you bring it up, I would like to let your audience know that we've just started a new open source investigation trying to piece together all of the information that we can find from all of the different countries of the world about moving towards a cashless society. Because I noticed earlier this week there was a story up about Norway, and the largest bank in Norway, one of the executives of that bank, gave an interview to a newspaper saying that they want to move Norway into a cashless society. And it was one of those stories that we see those types of stories come and go through the news all the time. And so I had the idea, I want to actually collect as many of those types of pieces of information as we can about all the different the countries that it's taking place in. The French restriction on cash transactions, the Spanish restriction on cash transactions, the Indian and Israeli and Canadian and Filipino and all the other governments that are moving towards eliminating cash or phasing cash out or restricting cash. So we're starting that right now. And so Corbett Report members are leaving their comments there, and I'm trying to put it into the article. And we're amassing quite a collection of these types of stories. It's quite interesting.
Well, it is interesting because it's a global phenomenon. And it seems to be just taking place. And people, it's as if you're watching a flock of birds flying overhead. So, oh, look at that. A bunch of geese are flying south or whatever. No one seems to look at this and say, wait a second, this is happening globally and it can't just be coincidental. The powers that be are mandating this, and it's only a question of time, presumably, before it happens in China, in Japan, and here in the United States. We aren't going to have any cash.
Well, this is the point to me of this and so many other stories, is that we always tend to just see what's happening in our local area and think of that as the sort of news, but it is happening all around the world simultaneously. And to a certain extent, with a story like this, you understand new technologies are coming online and banks are going to try to take advantage of them. But it is something that is happening all around the world at the same time, and we have to be aware we are stepping into this completely controlled, completely surveilled transaction grid that is locking into place. And when you pepper that in with stories about how these international banking agreements, like the FATCA agreement that the U.S. has tried to strong-arm various countries around the world into signing so that they all give up their personal banking information over to the U.S. authorities. I mean, those types of things, when you put them together, it's a world where increasingly you're not going to be able to do, buy, sell, or transact with anyone unless it's under the eye of the watchful central bankers and their bankster cronies. So it's worrying when you put it in that perspective. But of course, we never get that perspective from any one of these news stories.
I know, it's just taken for granted. Oh, isn't that that's kind of interesting, a little bit odd, but nobody's paying any attention to it. And it signals we're looking at some sort of an economic revolution, a political revolution that's taking place on a global basis right now, and nobody seems to mind. Nobody objects. Nobody speaks up, at least not significantly.
And I think it also further speaks to the fact that the political revolution you're talking about is fundamentally undergirded by a financial transactional infrastructure that is being carefully put into place by all these groups that are working in coordinated agenda. And again, unless you understand that part, you can fall into this political, let's vote for team A or team B, and as if it will make a fundamental difference to the control grid that mm-hmm. is going in right now.
I have suspected for years that the essence of the New World Order is fiat currency. If they don't have fiat currency, they're not going to run the world. With fiat currency, they can. Without fiat currency, they can't. If they can't spin currency out of thin air, well, to me, this is evidence. When they go ahead and they say there's not going to be any more cash, we're just going to do it. We'll have digital currency. Everyone's going to have a little plastic card. For me, this is New World Order. This is evidence that they are getting close to trying to impose something. How long do you suppose it's going to be before the world either wakes up and starts to put the brakes on this, resist this, or this becomes a fait accompli and everybody's going to have little plastic cards?
Well, I don't think we'll have to wait very long for the answer to that. The Danish government has set the deadline of 2030 for eliminating cash from Denmark. And Australia, a new survey that's come out from a banking group with online banking services. So, take this report for what it's worth. But at any rate, they say that they're predicting Australia to be cash free by 2022. And we have similar pronouncements coming out around the world, with actually some countries really moving quite close to that precipice already. I think Canada's down to something like the 8% mark in terms of overall transactions. How many are actually cash based at this point? Something down around 8%. I mean, it's not inconceivable that they'll be able to squelch that down below 1% in the near future. So especially yep. because the Canadian government,
same thing in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding, and I may be mistaken about this, but it's my understanding that about 95% of our transactions right now are achieved with plastic, or at least with checks, but not with paper dollars. Only represents about 5% of the transactions, which means we're almost cash free already.
I would have to check those numbers. I know that the actual money supply itself is something like 5% or even less actual cash, but I'm not sure about the transaction percentage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't even know if you can get accurate. You can get numbers that you can rely on. Mm. You hopefully rely on. It's part of the problem.
Well, that is part of the problem from the banker's perspective, because they don't know how many dollar bills people have stuffed under their mattresses or buried in the backyard. So, until they get that complete control over the financial system that comes with that cashless society, they will never be able to fully know exactly how much money is in circulation.
I saw one report where they guesstimated that 75% of all of the paper dollars in the world, not digital paper, but 75% are overseas. They're in foreign hands, and they hold them as world reserve currency, and banks, they hold them in their mattresses, whatever, and that only 25% of the total currency that's printed right now, physical currency, only about 25% is actually in circulation in the United States. So I don't know. The whole thing is strange, and we are living, in interesting times.
Yeah.
Ancient, well, it, what unfortunate, was it, Chinese or Japanese curse?
Yeah. But unfortunately, that is not surprising to people in, say, Brazil right now, or Argentina or Venezuela, where they're having incredible turmoil in their own markets right now. So holding dollars, if people had been holding their savings in dollars, US dollars, it would have been beneficial to them at this point, as their currencies are now collapsing, which is why I think you see that hoarding of physical dollars in a lot of places around the world.
I saw an article just recently, and I know that I have it here close at hand. Here it is. Not even the darkest minds imagine it would be this bad for China. That's the headline. This is from Business Insider. There are other things to talk about in this article, but one of the things they talked about is that you can blame a good portion of the chaos, the problems in China, on the depreciating value of the yuan, which has spurred holders of the currency to ditch it for something more stable. Right? Now, that's an interesting statement to me, because they didn't say they're going to ditch it for something more valuable. They said they're going to ditch it for a fiat, for another fiat currency, which is, and they're all technically worthless, but they're looking for a fiat currency that's more stable. It doesn't have to be precisely stable, but it doesn't change as rapidly. And so they are pulling their wealth out of China and moving it, looking for a more stable worthless currency. And that strikes me as interesting. Not more valuable, more stable. Does it, does that inspire any comment out of you?
I see the distinction. Having said that, as I say, for people who are living through currency devaluation, I don't think whether or not something has a commodity backing it up is of primary importance. Again, if you're in Brazil and you're suddenly seeing your life savings being flushed down the toilet because of currency depreciation, you don't care if the dollar fundamentally doesn't have gold backing it up. You just want something that will buy you bread.
Yeah.
So, I mean, value is what people make of it to that extent. But I think I understand the point that you're making, that ultimately what we are in is the system where all of these various central banks have these competing fiat currencies, and it's a question of, you know, which one will be the better investment for now, or what will be more stable, or what can you hang on to the value that you have with. And it becomes that type of calculation. So you understand why the Chinese nouveau riche would be trying to secure some of their earnings in something that's more quote-unquote stable. But yeah, I see the point that you're making, that at the end of the day, I mean, there's nothing to prevent the U.S. dollar from becoming unstable. In fact, that's exactly where it's heading in the long term.
Well, again, here's the headline. Not even the darkest minds imagined it would be this bad for China. And what they're saying is $1 trillion in capital fled from China in 2015. Previous years, they only lost about $130 billion. Per year. Now all of a sudden they're losing $1 trillion per year. The government predicted they'd lose about $455 billion. They've actually lost about $1 trillion. This situation has deteriorated rather very rapidly. Is this article, the idea that things are dark for China, is this hyperbolic, or is this an accurate assessment of what's happening in China right now?
I think it is not far off the mark. I don't know how far or close it may be, but it isn't so far off the mark, just based on the actions of the People's Bank of China right now, which is furiously injecting liquidity into the markets. And I don't have the tally of exactly how much has been injected so far this year, but I note, well, one of the headlines still on the front page of Zero Hedge as we record this conversation, that China is injecting another $50 billion, dollars worth, $340 billion yuan, of liquidity into the Chinese markets. So they are desperately attempting to prop up the yuan right now, but devaluation is the order of the day, I think, and I think that's where it's heading. So of course, the knock-on effects of that we've already seen in the way that they have been unable to contain the falling stock market, and the devaluation of the yuan is the sort of 1-2 punch of all of the disasters that we see spreading out through the Asian markets. And of course, we know that also affects U.S. markets at this point. So again, I think it's not really, that isn't the underlying problem, but it is a symptom of the problem. The underlying problem, I think, is the slowdown in global trade. You can cover up any sort of, you know, ridiculous and untenable positions. As long as global trade is growing and everything's booming for the manufacturing sector, everything's fine and they can cover everything over. But they can't do that right now because global trade is contracting and the Chinese economy is contracting, or at least is not growing as quickly as it was before. So, so absolutely, I think this is the inflection point that a lot of people have been predicting for years now with regards to China. And a lot of people have been saying it's the emperor with no clothes. And everything that we've seen in the last 6 months, really, since the stock market started crashing, is showing more and more that that's the case.
Do you think China's going to get things under control in the near future? Or how long is this problem going to persist?
I think it's the beach ball underwater effect. I think they can push down on various places using various mechanisms, but they can only do so for so long, and it only works for so long. And if you look at all sorts of different factors, like the offshore yuan, which, unlike the official PBOC yuan, is officially traded in a certain range that is fixed each day. The offshore yuan that you can buy in Hong Kong and other places is freely traded. And if you look at that, they keep trying to do these things, injecting liquidity and things, in order to keep the USD CNH value down, but it keeps spiking back up. So I think that, again, they keep trying to do things, and their interventions have less and less of an effect. And we've seen all of the other things they've been trying to do to prop up markets in various ways, the 7% circuit breaker that they tried very briefly and then repealed that we talked about last week, and other things like that. A new story coming out about how China is going to start using public funds to cover venture capital losses. So again, they've got a lot of tricks up their sleeve, but they are increasingly tricks that are having less and less effect on actually affecting the markets.
Well, the big problem the markets have is a loss of demand. People aren't buying stuff. What do you suppose the reason is for that? Is it simply, and there's not exactly a reason, it's a circular situation where the problem is caused by another problem, it's caused by another problem, it's caused by the first problem we were talking about in the first place. There's a circle here, but if you had to, what's causing the loss of demand? Are we fatigued by debt? That's the term I saw someone use, debt fatigue. We've just had enough of debt. I don't want to go in. I'm not going into, I don't care. That's a great deal on the car, but I'm not going into any more debt. Is that part of the mindset?
I would phrase this as a debt hangover or a QE hangover, really. Because Mike Maloney has been showing a chart which is quite revealing lately, where he charts the Wiltshire 5000, which is the market cap weighted index of all of the stocks that are traded in the U.S. So a pretty good indication of general market activity in the U.S. And he's charting that against the Federal Reserve balance sheet. And there is no doubt there is a direct relation between the two. And I think we can understand how it's a causal relationship. The Fed QE injections of money into the reserves of these various banks is directly related to the markets and where they've been going over the last 7 or 8 years. Because I think it doesn't need a lot of elaboration that what we've seen in the markets over the last several years with those record levels is not a reflection of economic activity. So what we have seen is the QE-driven market bubble, and what we are seeing is that now that they're taking that back and trying to raise rates, we're seeing the unwinding of that. It's quite obvious. And that, obviously, the markets, again, don't indicate the economic activity, but they indicate the psychology of various players in the market, and including, I think this ultimately filters down to the Main Street level and what people are willing to buy in their own lives. So I think just seen a contraction of demand based on that, the sucking up of the liquidity.
I think what I've observed over the last few months makes it increasingly clear that people aren't investing in the markets in the sense that you go in and you say, well, General Motors is a good stock. We've got good price earning ratio and whatever and strong company. They're not doing that where they look at the market, they look at market fundamentals. They are investing based on what the Federal Reserve says is happening. Federal Reserve uses a word, right? And all of a sudden the market goes up, or they don't use the word and the market goes down. We're investing in Federal Reserve activity. As long as we think they're going to support the market, we'll invest. If they're not going to support the market, we bail out. It's not about fundamentals. We'll talk more about that in a moment when we return to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Adisk here with my guest, James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, Corbett, report.com. James is located in Japan, and here's an article from the Phoenix Capital Research, and the headline is, "The Japanese Central Banker Just Leaked Something Incredible." They point out that European Central Bank and the U.S. Federal Reserve began implementing ZIRP, zero interest rate policy and quantitative easing, after 2008. But the Bank of Japan has been employing both ZIRP and quantitative easing since 2001 without any significant effect. They haven't been able to really stimulate their economy. Banker admitted this, just the head of the Bank of Japan, Haruhiko Kuroda, probably didn't get that. I may be close on that. I'm not sure if I pronounced it at all correctly, but the head of the Bank of Japan, he made a number of statements, and according to this article, one of the statements is an implicit admission that quantitative easing doesn't generate GDP growth. Anyone who studied quantitative easing knew this already, but it's an incredible admission from a central banker. These are the people responsible for instilling confidence in the system. This has just come out recently. It reminds me of Richard Fisher, who's the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank. And he admitted recently the cause of the stock market decline shouldn't be blamed on China, but rather on the Federal Reserve. This is just a coincidence of two people that are in or close to the heads of central banks, and they're both saying blame the banking system, not China?
No, I think it's pretty much just an observation of reality that is difficult to deny at this point. And they're not the only ones. I have seen this formulation several times in the last few years from a lot of different people similarly placed within the banking system. And unfortunately, I don't have those references offhand. But I remember a particularly humorous one was from a former Federal Reserve governor. I can't remember which Federal Reserve Bank, but one of the Federal Reserve banks was admitting that the Federal Reserve didn't understand really how QE fundamentally worked. They were just kind of, you know, going on a whim and a prayer. So these types of admissions have been made several times over the last years. And I think to some extent, I believe that some of these admissions are made to salt the record so that in retrospect, they'll be able to point to various admissions like these and go, look, see, we knew it. We were right. Even when they clearly pursued the wrong course of action for so long. I wouldn't say that the Japanese QE has been completely without effect, though. I think we certainly saw a run-up in the Japanese stock market over the last couple of years, which is now unwinding as they begin to lose control of that. But we certainly did see that effect, and we did see the devaluation of the yen. The JPY-USD did change over the last couple of years to weaken the yen. But again, it's the balloon, balloon underwater. They just can't keep it underwater for very long.
Well, it's the same thing with China. They're trying to use quantitative easing, which really hasn't been, it's had some positive effect. It has perhaps prevented nations and or the global economy from just utter collapse. Could have happened after 2008, 2007, 2008. Could have gone completely south. They stopped it from going completely south. But they pretty much stopped it just at the border. We almost went to Mexico. We didn't quite go into Mexico, but we almost went that far. What do you make of China trying to use quantitative easing to solve its problems? They have to know it didn't work for Japan to a significant degree. It didn't work for the United States to a significant degree. Is there really any hope that this is going to work for China?
Well, I guess we have to be careful because quantitative easing does have a technical definition, which does not really describe most of the interventions that the Chinese government or the People's Bank of China have been making. Specifically, quantitative easing is buying certain assets like treasuries or mortgage-backed securities or that type of thing, direct buying of that by the central bank in an attempt to load liquidity into the reserves of these banks. That is not the way China has been doing it. So it's been termed China's QE or Chinese-style QE or it's been analogized, but I don't think that's an accurate analogy when you get down to the technical level. So what they're doing is not exactly what the Federal Reserve has been doing, but certainly they have just been throwing, they're increasingly just throwing money at the markets and hoping, you know, that will make a difference. And I think we are seeing that's not having the effect. So I think they're going down a similar path, but not really the same path. They're just taking a different route to get there.
I wrote an article just lately of something that I believe is probably correct. Well, we can talk about that later. Here's another one. Here's an article from Newsroom. It says, sheer panic. The headline, sheer panic. Bank runs have begun in Italy. This is about a week old, 6 days old. Milan, a run has begun on Italian banks with depositors taking out money in a panic, fearing they will lose everything if they leave their money deposited. Is this more exaggeration? Is there really a potential panic taking place in Italy, or is this confined to one or two banks and not really a trend? Just a couple of bumps in the road.
That's a very good question. I'm going to have to admit I didn't see the stories of that particular incident, so I can't really comment on it specifically, but it certainly does seem to be a reflection of the fact that the Eurozone banking crises are certainly not under control, and the contagion, as it were, is still spreading around in the system, and could, who knows where it could strike next? One of the so-called pigs countries, like Italy, or could it spread to the rest of the system? I mean, I think this is still very much an open question, one that has been perhaps conveniently swept under the rug by other events taking place in Europe right now that grab the headlines, but the banking crises there are still certainly not under control. So to hear that there was a banking run last week in Italy does not surprise me, unfortunately, and I think it's, again, just reflective of the fact that the situation is still very much up in the air in the Eurozone generally.
George Soros has made a comment that he thinks that Europe is in danger of some sort of collapse. Is that a reasonable, or again, is that an exaggeration?
Well, no. I mean, again, it really depends on a number of factors, but one of them that I think we should at least be taking into account here is the possibility of Brexit, as they're now calling it, that the UK is actually going to have a referendum, supposedly. I think by the end, before the end of 2017, they're going to have a referendum on exiting the Euro, the European Union, which is not the Eurozone, but will obviously have a fundamental effect on the European Union project in general, if it does take place, and will undoubtedly affect the Eurozone as an economic entity as well, even though Britain, of course, is not a member of the Eurozone. But, I mean, those types of considerations, including the ongoing crisis in Greece, it's not that that crisis has been fully resolved, it's just that it's not making daily headlines anymore, but certainly things like that can again flare up, or you can have Italian bank runs or other things that start to spread panic. So the idea that the Eurozone is out of danger is, I mean, I think you'd have to be naive to believe that. It's just a question of, you know, I think fundamentally, again, the question for me is, which way will the Eurozone fail? Will they fail forward in a way that's convenient for the central bankers to step in and say, hey, you know, this just proves we need even more control?
We had an article here from Zero Hedge that was published yesterday, and the headline was "Something Snapped at the Comics." And it says, in part, it says, yesterday, when the latest update from the COMEX vault came in, we learned that a whopping 201,000 ounces of registered gold had been de-warranted at the owner's request and shifted to the eligible category, reducing the total amount of COMEX registered gold by 73% from 275,000 to just 74,000 overnight. I know what they're talking about is how much gold can be delivered. And on they say, this means the ratio of physical to paper gold dilution right now is in the neighborhood of 542 ounces of paper claims against every ounce of physical gold. Does this imply... that the real cost, that a legitimate price, if there's 500 ounces of paper gold claims on each 1 ounce of physical gold, does this suggest the price of physical gold should be 500 times the current price?
I'm not sure.
I know that sounds irrational.
No,
I know that they had $50,000 an ounce.
Yeah, $50,000 gold. Well, I mean, I don't think it's quite as simple as that, because we can imagine a market in which there is room for some paper transactions as well. But clearly 500 plus ounces to one is ridiculous. And the idea that this is fundamentally a sustainable move in the market is, again, ridiculous. So various people have estimated this in various ways over the years, and I believe I have seen the $50,000 an ounce number floated as the realistic sum. But
yeah, I've seen people talk about it.
But I'm not sure if we'll ever get there. But the idea that this is, I mean, that the current prices are maintainable is, again, I mean, it's only a reflection of people's faith in the fiat system and the monies that they're getting from their central banks. So in times of crisis, I mean, exactly as we're talking about with Brazil or whatever, and people holding U.S. physical U.S. dollars, again, holding precious metals can be the exact same type of hedge that people use, except in this case, it's a universally recognized hedge that's been operating for thousands of years. So again, all this type of story really says to me, and I don't know about you, but I've seen this type of story several times over the last several years that I've been following this. All it says is, don't buy paper gold at this point. I mean, if you don't have it in your hand, assuming you're buying it as a hedge, if you're just buying it as an investment, you want to turn it around and, you know, come in and out of the market, then sure, whatever, play the paper and, you know, suffer the consequences if they come. But if you are buying precious metals as a hedge against possible currency collapse or calamity or global currency reset or anything of that sort, then buy physical metal that you can physically hold in your hand, or else you don't really have it.
I agree. We've got probably 2 minutes left. We've got an article here from Ms. Shedlock. It says, Fourth Industrial Revolution, robots, artificial intelligence will destroy 5.1 million jobs by 2020. He's quoting from a study, The Future of Jobs, by the World Economic Forum at Davos, claims that a fourth industrial revolution is coming, that Japan may be something like the canary in the coal mine. I'm going to guess that Japan has far more robots on a per capita basis than most other nations. Is that causing distress, or is it am I right, first off? And if so, is it causing distress in the Japanese economy, or are people just adjusting? No big thing.
I can't speak to the industrial uses of robotics in manufacturing or anything of that sort compared to other countries. I don't have the figures on that, but I can say, at least for the general cultural conditioning to robots, even on the personal level, I would say Japan is much more advanced in that there are they've even recently released, you know, kind of personal robots that are supposed to be more and more a part of daily life here. And I've seen them at certain stores where it's just a novelty item at this point. But basically you come in and you can hold a little conversation with this robotic friend. So it's, I mean, the public is definitely being indoctrinated into accepting it at this point, and it's becoming more sort of natural seeming to people who are steeped in this. But again, how that translates in the business world compared to other countries, I'm not sure of. But it is a trend that I don't see derailing anytime in the near future. I think the only question is whether these robot workers will be paid with digital virtual currency.
Maybe Bitcoin. We could give them Bitcoin, perhaps. Want to thank you for being on the program. As always, James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com.